mostly government institutions should provide, you know, the legal framework, the regulatory framework for fair competition, for the market to win out, for the journalistic organizations that have the best ideas and can handle complicated transitions to survive and thrive, and for the AI companies that have the best ideas to survive and thrive. I think of AI, it's kind of changing everything, every sort of layer of our business, right? So I think it fundamentally like will change search, right? And once you change search, you've changed the whole architecture of the internet, right? The internet and the open web, what we access through browsers, open source is just too risky, right? You take these tools, you open source them, you put them in the hands of individuals who could do all kinds of damage. So there are all these things that make it hard for AI to genuinely replace a job or somebody's work. And there's, you know, we're 2.5 years into this. How many companies have really like laid off their white collar workers and replaced them with AI? Like, if you look what Instagram did to society, right? And you look at the kind of the insecurities and some of the, it did a lot of good, and I use Instagram and, you know, I like to post my running photos there. But if you look at like what it did to the self-esteem of teenagers, and if you look at what it did to, you know, the way we learn, the way we communicate, the way that young people date, the way they're out in the world, like it did a lot of harm.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast, dedicated to bringing together global voices to shape fair, responsible, and trustworthy AI policies worldwide. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have the privilege of speaking with one of the most influential voices at the intersection of technology, media, and society. Joining us on the eve of the AI for Good Summit, where I'll be there too, in Geneva is Nicholas Thompson, CEO of The Atlantic. Under Nicholas's leadership, The Atlantic has reached its highest subscriber base and count since its founding in 1857, while also becoming a leading voice in the critical conversation about AI's impact on society. Nicholas also brings a unique perspective to our discussion today. He was the former editor-in-chief of Wired. He's been at the forefront of technology journalism for over 2 decades. And as the host of the Most Interesting Thing in AI podcast and creator of a daily video series on technological change with over 2 million followers, he's interviewed virtually every major figure in the AI field since he began talking about AI globally in 2017. I could go on and on, but Nicholas, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thanks, Sanjay. I'm delighted to be here on the podcast, and I look forward to seeing you in Geneva.
Absolutely. Nicholas, we have a global audience, US, Europe, Asia. These are people who are in the AI world, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and, you know, just folks who are working, building cool things in AI. So, it's going to be a fascinating conversation, but you're heading to Geneva just like I am. Yeah. For the AI for Good Summit. And there you'll be interviewing some pretty incredible people, Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, you know, some of the godfathers of AI, and also Mark Benioff from Salesforce. So as someone who has virtually interviewed every major AI figure, what are some of the questions you're most eager to explore with these three different perspectives? And these are very three different perspectives, I'm sure you understand, on AI's future.
Yeah, they're three very different voices. They're three extremely interesting people. They're three people I've interviewed, each of them multiple times before. With each of them, I'm going to, you know, bring a different set of questions, a different set of problems. You know, with Benioff, it's really about businesses and the speed of this transformation. He's been talking about the number, the amount of work at Salesforce that gets done by AI, the speed at which they are creating AI agents, the way the AI agents work with humans. I think there are a lot of lessons from him. He's also a very important voice in debate over climate oceans, environmental sustainability. Since this is a UN AI summit, we're going to get into those topics. With Jeff Hinton, he's one of the most articulate people about some of the risks of AI. He has a very deep-seated fear about what could go wrong, some smart ideas on what could go right as well. But I want to understand from him, as he's watched the last couple of years, I talked to him last year at the same summit, how his perspective has shifted, right? As we've seen certain things speed up, certain things slow down, I'm going to ask him about some recent papers, some recent findings. Jan is also an extremely interesting case where he's right at the center of Facebook and very much at the center of open source AI, which I consider one of the most important topics in AI, the degree to which open source companies, open weight models become part of the future AI ecosystem. So I'll be asking him about that. I'll be asking him about what has been happening at Meta. And I'll be asking him about, he's always been quite skeptical about the capabilities of large language models, particularly those built on scaling laws. And I want to ask him about how those perceptions have shifted. So those are a little bit about what I'll ask the three of them.
Well, we'll be tuning in because it's really going to be fascinating. Very three different perspectives. Yeah. And Mark wanted to change his company's name to Agentforce, et cetera, but that we won't go there. Yeah. So it's an Agentforce company. Nicholas, the Atlantic has really thrived under your leadership. While I'm sure it's no surprise to our listeners, a lot of media organizations have struggled with AI's disruption. Yeah. From your vantage point, you're leading a 167-year-old legacy institution. How should regulatory frameworks balance protecting legacy industries like journalism, which are very critical for many, many different things, while also fostering AI innovation?
Yeah. I mean, there's only, mostly government institutions should provide, the legal framework, the regulatory framework for fair competition, for the market to win out, for the journalistic organizations that have the best ideas and can handle complicated transitions to survive and thrive, and for the AI companies that have the best ideas to survive and thrive. That's what you want. You want a fair market, you want a fair fight, you want fair competition. There is one specific issue which, I've talked about and I do think is important, which is I do think that the original sin of these AI companies, and I love these AI companies, I use them all the time, but there's an original sin in that they went and they scraped the entire web. And in many cases, they took data sets of pirated content, including from The Atlantic and other publishers. And at the time, they didn't have money. They didn't want to deal with legal compliance. They didn't want to deal with all that, as some documents have said, that legal blah, blah. And so they pressed ahead and built these models and never compensated the creators. And so that's an issue, right? And so if they're building models that compete, they're building products that compete with journalistic organizations, as they do in some ways, and they've built it sometimes on pirated data, sometimes just on data that was scraped in the dead of night, that needs to be worked out. And it doesn't need to be worked out by the government. It doesn't need to be worked out by the courts. It can be worked out by the media companies and the AI companies, but it does need to be worked out. So there has to be a fair exchange of value. And so that is something that we are engaged in at The Atlantic. We're engaged in it. We have a deal with OpenAI. We have conversations with many other companies. We're involved in a consortium that is part of a lawsuit. The thing I would most like is for the AI companies to build products that drive readership to media organizations and that compensate media organizations or creators, whether musicians, artists, for their contributions to the products that the AI companies have built. That's the best way to do it. If that is not built, then there are other solutions, which include, lawsuits or government action.
So let's just go a little bit deeper into this, because you saw the recent Anthropic ruling, which you noted is a mixed message on fair use. How should regulators reconcile this transformative use with creator compensation? And What are some of the solutions? I mean, do you see collective bargaining by publishers as inevitable, or is there a better market-based solution?
Yeah, that's some really interesting parts to that question. So, you know, there were two cases, I think, last week. One involved Anthropic, one involved Meta. Mm-hmm. Somewhat divergent, both mixed bags. You know, both district courts cases, so don't really provide full clarity. In the Anthropic case, what they said is that, you know, Anthropic's use of the books that they trained on was in fact transformative and therefore fair use, mm-hmm. at least for the books they paid for, the books that they yeah. pirated. No, that's not okay. So you have to compensate mm-hmm. the authors of the books you pirated, but the books you paid for, that's fair. In the Meta case, the judge actually said, you know, in this particular case, you know, Meta wins, but mostly because the case wasn't brought the right way. And in fact, if you read yeah. that ruling, the judge says, if you're building an AI product that competes with the stuff you trained on, as it seems is the case here, and as certainly as seems the case in media, the judge particularly notes, mm-hmm. then that's a severe problem. And so what you there have is a complicated question. It's a complicated question in American law, and then also just in general ethics. If you take something, you transform it, and then you build something that is partially but not completely competitive, what are your obligations? And in the Meta case, it seemed very much the judge was saying your obligation is to compensate the people for the training. In the Anthropic case, less so, but don't pirate. So I don't know what the ultimate lessons are. To your question about collective bargaining,
mm-hmm. by publishers, hard.
You know, collective bargaining for publishers, that's hard because of antitrust regulation. You're not actually allowed to, you know, get together and do that, or there are limitations on it. So there are, you know, there are organizations that publishers are part of. There are trade groups. You know, the lawsuit that we're involved in is brought through the News Media Alliance, which is a group that we are part of. I do think that that will be part of the solution. You know, ultimately, I think that I hope that there's going to be a technical solution. For example, let me just talk about one company that, you know, we work with. It's called ProRata. What they're doing is they're building a tool to identify in an AI search how much the different publishers contribute to the information that was given. You make a search, you say, what happened in Iran today? And your answer comes, you know, 6% from The Atlantic. Then the model would be, okay, so 6% of some revenue share percentage, let's say 50-50, so 3% of the revenue that is generated by the AI company on that search maybe goes back to The Atlantic. Like, that is a fair model. My hope is that there's a solution like that that works across the market.
So what you're saying is when we look at a Perplexity, they have these this percentage answer, this percentage answer. Nicholas, these companies are slowly veering into becoming the operating system, really, to, you know, I'm sure when you're using whatever tool you use a lot for basic things, how is that going to move the needle in terms of publishing and the challenges of publishing? Because it's not simple links that they're saying, okay, go to Atlantic and find this story. That world is a little different, isn't it?
No, the world, so I think of AI, it's kind of changing everything, every sort of layer of our business, right? So I think it fundamentally, like, will change search, right? And if you, once you change search, you've changed the whole architecture of the internet, right? The internet and the open web, what we access through browsers, you know, for the last 25 years or the last, geez, almost 30 years has been, you know, mediated by Google, which you go to Google, you search for something, then you go out. Now you'll just search for something and it will just answer it, right? And so that will denigrate the rest of the web, right? The rest of the web could shrink, it could go to zero, who knows what's going to happen, but certainly the rest of the web will become less important a thing, right? And browsers will become less important. So that matters to the publishing industry because that's how we get a lot of our revenue. People go to The Atlantic. Now, some people will still go to The Atlantic. You'll type in theatlantic.com, you're going through a newsletter, you're going through social media. There are many ways you will get there. Some people will still go in through Google, some will go in through Perplexity links, right? So there will be a whole different ecosystem for how people find us. So that's part what's going on. Then there will be a whole different method by which publishers create content. Right? Some people will use it for writing. We don't do it at The Atlantic, but people do use it for research, for thinking. You know, these tools make us so much smarter. It should make, you know, journalism and the content produced by publishers much smarter. So we should be able to produce more content in better ways by having the best people working with the best tools. Right? I just wrote a book. Book is coming out. It's about running. I used AI all the time, never to write anything, not one word, but to think through things, right? And to help me understand complicated concepts. So it's changing the ecosystem by which we find things. It's going to change the ecosystem by which we read things. We will have AI tools. We will send out agents to the web to get us information, to summarize us, to find the facts we want. It'll change the means of production. So you're kind of changing every step along the way. So as a CEO, I have to figure out how to position my company to succeed on all those different fronts as best I can, recognizing that no one can really see. Like, we're 2.5 years since ChatGPT launched. No one can really see where this is going.
Just to follow up, Nicholas, I'm just thinking, is there a generational issue here too? If you're a 16-year-old, 15-year-old, 17-year-old, or a 14-year-old, and you're just coming off on ChatGPT or, you know, take Claude or whatever you want to do, and you're getting that information, and that's all you have gotten. You don't know Atlantic. You don't know any of these other things. And you grow up in that environment. How does, I mean, I know it's hard to figure out, but I see what some of these young people, you know, on their mobile, is that a possibility?
Well, I mean, that's really interesting, right? We've kind of gone through it with social media, mm-hmm. right? Where people go through and young people read less than they did in the previous generation. They read fewer books. Mm-hmm. There's still plenty, and there's still plenty of young people who subscribe to The Atlantic and love The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. I wonder sometimes, I kind of think that the effect on young people of AI will be less bad for publications like us than social media. I mean, if AI ends up creating these sort of false, fake worlds inside of social media that are infinitely attractive, maybe. But like, The Atlantic thrives when people are curious about the world, when they're, you know, educated, when they, you know, love words, when they love complicated thoughts. And AI, you know, AI makes us all smarter, right? It deepens our curiosity. It is an amazing tool for trying to learn more about the world. So maybe young people who grow up in AI will actually be more likely to be Atlantic subscribers. I don't know. I'm gonna bet on AI making the next generation incredibly smart, and I'm gonna bet that that's good for increasing our readership.
Okay. Well, you are an optimist, and so am I, and I hope that happens. It is definitely making us smarter, even though there are some people who say it's less. But you have talked about, and you know, I live in Washington, D.C., and we just are going through this big, beautiful bill, which had this state piece of regulation, which you saw the proposal and you called a real, I think you called it a really bad idea for regulating AI. So now I interview a lot of members of Congress and Senate and governors on this show. Their issue is that we need some time to get federal regulation in, but 10 years is way too much. There was an issue that we, I think Senator Blackburn wanted it for 5 years, et cetera, et cetera. Your thoughts on that? You just don't think we should leave the states to do what they need to do?
Well, I mean, the specific piece of legislation was insane, right? And it said no state legislation on AI for 10 years. I mean, come on, like, we're a federalist country. Like, I understand the argument that it is hard for a big company to maneuver when you have to deal with different regulations in 50 different states. And I understand that it is hard when you have some states like California that regulate you one way and states like Texas or Vermont regulate you mm-hmm. in different ways. Mm-hmm. Hard stuff, but it's not the role of the federal government to say the states can regulate on everything, but they can't regulate on AI. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that is particularly not the case because it's not like the federal government is regulating on AI. if the federal government, I would be slightly, partially, a little bit more sympathetic if there was going to be a set of rational rules that Congress was going to pass, and they want to preempt all state legislation. So they say, hey, we're introducing a national AI bill. It will do X, Y, and Z, and we are preempting state legislation. That is a more logical position than, nah, you know what, just screw the states, no state rulings. So I thought that bill was terrible. Not that I agree with all the state rulings. Some of the states have terrible regulation ideas. But in general, I was very much against it. I was glad that was stripped from Trump's budget bill.
So, yeah, that happened yesterday. So, Nicholas, in your podcast, you know, the most interesting thing in AI, it's given you deep insights into, you know, how AI leaders think about regulation. What's the biggest disconnect you have seen? Now, as I said, you're going to talk to some incredible, three of the most incredible people at the AI for Good. What's the disconnect you see between AI developers or foundation companies and what they want from regulation and what policymakers are actually proposing in some ways?
That's a hard question. I think maybe I'll answer it in three ways. Like, I think what developers want, right? You want individuals. They want fair competition. They want fair rules. I think they probably want an ecosystem where there's lots of competition, which you would get through enforcing antitrust by, you know, creating rules around data portability, where you would use the government to create public systems that developers and academics can access. Like, that's something I believe in strongly. I think that's what developers want. I think developers want a diverse community of lots of people building lots of tools that can be shared in the optimal ways and where you don't have lock-in network effects and just a few big winners. I think the large tech companies, you know, believe a little bit of the opposite, which is they do think the world would be safer if there are just a few big winners. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that it would be helpful to them as well. And so they're in favor of legislation that sort of smooths their path to that, for good and for ill. Policymakers, I think, for the most part, a little bit focused the wrong way. They're focused on, a lot of the conversation is around how to mitigate the biggest harms, which is legitimate, you know, but I think that's not the right way to do it. Like, what we should be doing from a regulatory position right now is set up markets so they're maximally competitive, so that they're well-sourced, so that the government is using and creating tools and incentivizing, like, the best work. If the goal is, you know, the best, safest, most powerful AI built in this country, you know, what you want are clear rules, government support across the board.
So clear rules across the board. What do you think of the EU AI Act? I mean, I have, obviously I've talked to lawmakers here and say we are never doing that. Generally, there's a big consensus here. We are never doing that.
Yeah, you know, in general, I'm skeptical. I think the EU has shot itself in the foot through overregulation, right? I was a startup founder. I had a company, an AI company, trying to create positive social media experiences. We didn't even operate in Europe, right? We just couldn't handle GDPR, right? We didn't, like, our lawyers said, nobody under 13 and no Europeans, right? And that's, you know, why are there no giant AI companies in Europe? Well, a number of reasons. One, immigration. Two, market size. You know, three, regulation. And so in general, I'm skeptical of the EU's approach to regulation. On the EU AI Act, I actually don't think it was quite as onerous as previous regulations. I thought they drew smart lines. I thought they were relatively contained in what they demanded. So I'm not as critical. I'm no expert on the EU AI Act, and I haven't had a company that's had to navigate it. But I think they did a better job. I do think that there is a concerted effort in Europe right now to not regulate themselves out of the game in AI.
Yeah. Because we talked to a lot of European companies, and some of them, well, a lot of them want to come to the US for a lot of reasons, funding, regulations, etc. Nicholas, there is this whole debate, open source, closed source. I mean, you know, Meta is open source. Mistral has gone open source. What are your thoughts on this?
It's interesting. I sometimes think of this as the issue where my views have shifted the most in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that two years ago, I believed open source is just too risky, right? You take these tools, you open source them, you put them in the hands of individuals who could do all kinds of damage. Now I've kind of changed my mind, and I've changed my mind for a couple of reasons. One is I haven't seen that damage. I do believe that actually, like, the best way to counter bad AI is good AI. And so putting tools in the hand of good civic organizations is absolutely essential. I have found some of the people I've talked to have the highest commitment to helping shape AI for the greater good are working in open source. And I don't fully trust the big companies. So I'm actually pretty pro open source at this point, pretty open source AI at this point.
Well, also add DeepSeek and those things to the mix, because whether we open source or not, they've pushed it out. Even Alibaba is pushing it out on open source.
That's one of the greatest ironies of AI today, is that, you know, China, the great closed system, is pushing out the open source AI. I do think on this, you know, the China-US question, this is something where I also have strong views, where going back to your previous note, I think that there's a misperception that the US and China are locked in this AI arms race, and that one country will kind of cross some kind of a line first. Either the US will or China will. And if China does it, then suddenly they will dominate the world. And it is true that AI will affect national productivity. It is true that, you know, a country will be better off if the AI companies inside its borders are better off. It is not true that there is that one specific line. And it is not true that if it's crossed by an American company, you know, suddenly the United States will have a massive national security advantage. AI is too complex. There are too many different vectors. There are too many different forms of AI. There is no single threshold. And I think that the perception, which is pushed by all kinds of people in this debate, there's a line that can be crossed and that the US better get there first, I think it's been very damaging. It's led to a lot of bad thinking and bad policy proposals.
Well, again, I am in Washington, so that, you know, there is this whole thing in terms of chip exports and sovereign AI. Do you think we should be restricting exports of chips to China, since you brought this issue up?
You know, I'm not against... I wouldn't be an absolutist against chip exports, right? I mean, you do want, it's very hard to separate chips that can be used for AI, for foundational models, and chips that can be used for military. You know, you do want to make sure that American technology is not being used in Chinese military technology. There are all kinds of complex trade espionage issues involved in this. In general, I do think that the chip export ban, you know, supported by the Biden administration, supported by the Trump administration, has been not as effective as they hoped. It has not slowed down China as much as advocates of the ban hoped. We've seen this in DeepSeek. We've seen this in other Chinese advances. It is, in fact, probably helped Huawei more than any other company. Mm-hmm. So there has been a side effect. So it has not worked as intended. And I also think that as a general principle, the United States and China should be sharing more information, right? They should be sharing best practices. They should be sharing an understanding of where each other's AI is going, so that, you know, if humanity has a shared interest in protecting against super powerful AI, right? If we are really, you know, if there is a chance, as I think there is, that AI could become a existential threat to humanity, like, China and US better be cooperating on this. And I would like there to be more exchange of ideas between the US and China, more collaboration. So that's a long way of saying, I think the bans as put into effect have not been effective. I think they've been a little misguided, but I'm certainly no absolutist, and I certainly understand where some of the people who supported the bans are coming from.
Yeah, I mean, right now there is no appetite in this town for doing anything else besides the ban. Another thing that you talked about, which is something I focus a lot on, is this job apocalypse. That is, Dario has talked a lot about it, especially in the, even in the past few days, and there's been that debate between Jensen and Dario. What are your views on this? And then is there a role for government regulation in this? Tell our listeners, what do you think about this whole situation?
Well, on this, Dario, the CEO of Anthropic, has said, yes. I can't remember the exact stat, but right, like 50% of all white collar work will be wiped out in 3 years. And Jensen said that's nonsense. I'm more on this particular debate. I'm more on Jensen's side. Like, there's no doubt that AI has a risk to all kinds of white collar work, right? But one of the things that I think is true is that it's very easy to imagine why AI can wipe out somebody else's job. It's extremely hard to think about why AI can wipe out your own job. Now, why is that? Mm-hmm. Well, with your own job, you recognize just how messy it is. You recognize that, like, your job does involve some rote processing, but it also involves, like, doing this other complicated thing that's sort of hard to explain to a machine that involves talking to this other person and using this other team, right? Or it involves this thing that involves this complicated regulatory step that AI would never be allowed into, right? There's all these reasons, or it involves this thing that actually involves, like, real human to human connection. So there are all these things that make it hard for AI to genuinely replace a job or somebody's work. And there's, we're 2.5 years into this. How many companies have really, like, laid off their white collar workers and replaced them with AI? Like, it's just not happening. And it's not happening because AI is a great tool for making individuals more efficient, but it's not, like, a great replacement tool. So I think, that over time, yes, it will take away some jobs, it will replace some people's work. It's clearly having a huge effect on computer science, computer programmers. But I don't think we're heading towards the job apocalypse. To the second part of your question, yeah, this is where the government should play a big role in this, right? The government should know that, there will be changes, right? I'm trying to, like, have, like, a nuanced line where I am worried about the pace of change. I am worried about jobs changing. I don't think there's a job apocalypse. The government's role is to prepare society for more churn and more change, right, with AI, and to make sure that it's setting up job retraining, that it is figuring out the right way to incentivize educational institutions to, provide secondary training for people who have lost their jobs because of AI or who are in industries that are changed because of AI. Like, the government, it should be using government resources to basically help us figure out how to plan and how to get through. It should be, funding work programs for the kind of people who are most likely to be replaced, because you don't want chaos. And if AI does end up really changing certain professions, you could end up having chaos. So I think that the government also should probably fund this through a tax on, this is something that I do agree with Dario's, a tax on the AI companies. If there are massive profits from the AI companies, it can be redistributed into funds that help industries that are, upset by AI and people who lose their work because of AI. That seems like a rational proposal. So the government should be playing a role in making sure that society is as resilient as possible for the change that's coming.
So government should play a role, maybe a percentage of the revenues of these big AI companies should be there for potential retraining, reskilling. I don't know if you saw Microsoft announce a layoff, I think today or yesterday, 9,000 people. So it's actually hitting the people who are kind of the most in this industry, the software workers per se. And obviously, that's something that's pretty important, especially if you are now a new graduate trying to get a job. And you know, it was given if you got a STEM degree or a tech degree, you know, that was an easy path, but maybe not as much, Nicholas.
Yeah. I do think there is some concerning data on sort of the unemployment rate of, you know, 25-year-olds. And one of the things I worry about whole professions being wiped out. I worry a little bit about that. I worry more about, you know, the first rung of the ladder being wiped out. And so if you look at my profession, the one I most know, journalism, you know, traditionally you would go in and you would start your career. You go to finish college, you become a sports reporter. You write about the AAA baseball team. You know, eventually you move up the chain and you write more and more complex things as you go. And, you know, those early jobs will be replaced by AI. And I think that's true in a number of professions. So that's going to make it harder. But then the interesting question is, okay, so that makes it harder. Does it mean that it then pushes young people to be unemployed, or does it push them to start building the new structures for, you know, the new parts of society and the new companies? And like, I think a lot of them, you'll see a lot of entrepreneurial energy from them. So I worry about it, but I also think there's some upside.
Okay. Nicholas, the other thing that you have discussed also has been the AI's capability to diagnose medical conditions better than humans. I don't know if you saw Microsoft said it's recently, sorry to keep bringing up some of these stories, but their AI tools diagnose patients, I think, like 4 times better than, you know, actual physicians. What is there, how, you know, when you look at inner cities, rural areas where you really can't get, I mean, it's really hard for them to get physicians in there. Is there a role for AI, you know, especially GPs, general practitioners, et cetera? I mean, now your and my phone can basically do, sorry, with due respect to all the GPs that I know, but they can do a lot of what GPs can do. But what are the regulatory frameworks that could handle a scenario like this, where AI is outperforming humans in some critical decisions?
I mean, that's an amazing question and something we'll have to cope with or deal with. First off, it's, you know, like AI in medicine is great, right? And so it's great for lots of things. And the problem with AI is it can hallucinate, makes mistakes, BSs, but there are lots of situations in medicine where that's okay, right? And like, I find AI an extremely useful thing. I have a family member who's going through a series of complicated procedures. 2 years ago, I would have had to like get in the queue and call a doctor. I would have called my friend who's a doctor. Now I just sort of go to, you know, my model of choice and ask it, right? Very useful, providing information, helping understand it, right? Like, my son has something weird going on with his foot. I take a photograph. Okay, here's what's going on. Like, this is how you treat it at home, right? My at-home treatment has gotten much better, right? Like, I'm dealing with something in my ankle. Like, I describe it. I don't need to go to a doctor. I just need my ankle to hurt a little bit less. Okay, so this is how you do it, right? And so incredibly useful for that. The Microsoft paper is, you know, more complicated. It's like actually real medicine, real problems. And I'm curious like how this paper is vetted, right? Whenever a company puts out a paper that has like a great finding, you have to like let it sit and settle for a few weeks and wait till the doctors, professionals have looked at it, right? In this particular paper, it's very smart mechanism for having a mixture of AI agents communicating, diagnosing, comparing against real doctors. The doctors in the study weren't allowed to use the internet, so there's like a little bias in it. But it does suggest that there is a form of diagnosis that will be very helpful. I think in medicine, for diagnosis, you know, what we're going to want for the foreseeable future is humans who work with really great AI models. And I think that whoever can build the sort of the most sophisticated, most trusted AI model to be used by doctors in a hospital setting, and the doctors become experts in it, and they're able to kind of check their own judgments, you know, use the model to feed in information, I think it will make, and then the doctors, you know, convey it back to the patient, and the doctors are involved in the places where the model shouldn't be involved. I think that will be a huge benefit and will allow medicine to be much faster, allow telemedicine to be much more robust. I think it will have, you know, wonderful, wonderful impacts. Will it drive doctors and GPs out of business? I doubt it. You know, the demand for medicine versus the supply of doctors, it's so mismatched that having, you know, doctors be able to move faster, be more effective, more efficient, I think would just be a huge plus.
Just to just take it one step further, any thoughts on how AI is being used for companionship, behavioral things, you know, from depression, et cetera? And there have been results, you know, the former Surgeon General said loneliness is an epidemic. Can AI be a solution for something of that nature?
This is one of the hardest ones because yes, it can. And there will be real market opportunities for companies to build AI companions who are very useful, right? And help people who are depressed, who are lonely. And even people who aren't depressed, but just want, you know, need to talk to a model about something or other, right? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I go to a model and ask like complicated questions all the time. It's not a companion, but it's very useful to me. So that's good. But there's also a real risk that the companies that do this are going to make so much money and there's going to be, you know, so much honey available for them that they're going to end up building something that is actually destructive to us, where, you know, they suck us into a fake world and we lose some of our human-to-human interactions. And you can imagine, in my ultimate dystopic fear, you know, a new social media platform that is built and is like populated by perfectly beautiful, perfectly communicable, you know, men and women, you know, of your choice and your preference, who infinitely distract us and take us out of the real world. And so I see real danger here. If I could wave a magic wand and make it go away, of course I wouldn't do that, because there's so much good, right? There's real good that can come from having an AI bot that can talk to you about your problems and they can be, you know, be a friend for you there. There's just the danger of creating something, you know, like a real Westworld. The danger of that is quite high.
Yeah, when AI meets metaverse, imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people are afraid of a lot of AI outcomes. You know, I mentioned the sort of destruction of humanity, and, you know, there are AI experts, and Jeff Hinton talks extremely intelligently about it, Yoshua Bengio. You know, what happens if AI is misaligned with our values? What happens if, you know, the most powerful AI has a desire to cause a certain amount of harm? Like, could they build a biovirus? Like, I do worry about that, but I worry more about, if you look what Instagram did to society, right? And you look at the kind of the insecurities and some of the, it did a lot of good, and I use Instagram and, you know, I like post my running photos there. But if you look at like what it did to the self-esteem of teenagers, and if you look at what it did to, you know, the way we learn, the way we communicate, the way that young people date, the way they're out in the world, like, it did a lot of harm, right?
Yeah.
And that seems unambiguous right now. And AI could just be so much worse. And so we have to be ready for that.
We'll have to be ready for that. Nicholas, finally, you talk to such amazing people, which you do all the time. You're getting ready to talk to them. Are there some people that have, you know, maybe inspired your thinking on AI? I'm now talking specifically, or shaped your thinking in AI? For our audience, can you talk about that so they can follow them, listen to them?
Yeah. There are many, 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 many.
I'll pick a few.
I'll pick a couple. So there's Audrey Tong, who I think is one of the great thinkers of AI. She's the former digital minister of Taiwan. And some of my thinking on open source has been influenced a lot by Audrey and Audrey's view that there's a vertical race in AI, which is the big companies trying to reach maximally powerful AI, right? And then there's a horizontal race, which is like individual civic organizations trying to build the right tools in AI. And so what you need to have happen is you need to have enough civic organizations, enough good-hearted people, enough people, you know, really building human values into AI. And then if the horizontal race goes as quickly as the vertical race, then, you know, we'll end up with an aligned AI. I think that's important. So I'll give a shout out to Audrey, and then I'll give a second shout out, which is the Vatican, actually, you know, and like, if you had asked me at the beginning of this, I would have been quite skeptical that I would have thought that the view of the church would be to kind of reject AI and to sort of say it's, you know, it's an artificial creation and creates false gods. But like one of the best papers I read last year was the Vatican's paper on AI. And it was an extremely smart essay saying, look, you know, this is a creation of mankind. It's part of us. There is a risk that we will create false idols. There is a risk that it will lead to more income inequality. There's a risk that it will lead to violations of ethics. But here are some ways of thinking about it. Here's how it can be good. Here's how it can increase our, you know, quest for meaning. So if I were to recommend one thing for the listeners to read, it would be that document.
Yeah, fantastic. Great comments on that. We generally end the podcast for our listeners who are hooked onto TikTok and others, just to do a quick lightning round. You sure. Give us one word answers. You ready, Nicholas?
I'm good to go. Let's fire away.
Okay. One word answer. So AI regulation, urgent or premature?
Urgent.
Or premature?
It's hard because it's not really either, but one word, urgent. If I have to choose either or, I'm going to urgent.
Okay. I think I know the answer to this. I think you kind of answered it, but open source AI, democratizing or dangerous?
Democratizing.
Yeah. Do you think global AI governance, is it achievable or idealistic?
Achievable.
Okay. Let's ask something that's related to you. Content licensing for AI, mandatory or voluntary?
Mandatory.
AI safety research, adequate or insufficient?
Insufficient.
And then future of AI, optimistic or concerned?
Optimistic.
Awesome. Nicholas, thank you really for sharing your invaluable perspective with the regulating AI community.
You know, much fun, Sanjay. This is really great. I enjoyed all this. This is a wonderful conversation. You asked terrific questions and we got into some good stuff.
Yeah, it was really, really fabulous. You really gave us some great perspective, you know, the symbiotic relationship between AI companies and content creators, you know, rather than purely extractive ones, you know, that was pretty fantastic. And as you head to Geneva, you'll be continuing the Atlantic's long tradition of bringing critical conversations to the public square. Okay. So really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. Nicholas, really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much, Sanjay. It was a real pleasure to be here.